I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday, coming to you this week from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Later in the hour, might voters be judging candidates by the tone of their voices? But first, a little over a week ago, the Animas River in Colorado flowed with an unnatural hue, orange. You've seen the pictures by now, kayakers floating atop neon water as the plume of toxic orange yellow sludge, which eventually reached other states like Utah and New Mexico, all the result of a blowout at the Gold King mine in Silverton, Colorado, accidentally caused by the Environmental Protection Agency last Wednesday. They had been charged with cleaning up the contaminated site, and stuff went wrong. This week, Gina McCarthy, EPA administrator, spoke in Colorado.
So as you probably know, EPA's mission is to protect public health and the environment. No agency could be more upset about the incident happening, more dedicated in terms of doing our job and getting this right.
Joining me now to discuss current conditions along the river are two Colorado-based journalists who've been on the ground during this crisis. Grace Hood is the energy environment reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Jonathan Thompson, senior editor at High Country News, based in Durango, Colorado. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Having trouble hearing them, so I get it. Grace, what triggered the Gold King mine blowout?
There was an EPA contracting crew that was using heavy equipment up there, and they were really wanting to start the process of pumping and treating the contaminated water inside the mine. There were also EPA officials up there overseeing all the operations at the time, but there was an earthen dam that was breached, and that's pretty much what unleashed the 3 million gallons of orange water discharge that we've seen in so many pictures now.
And what is the state now? Have they reopened the river yet?
They are going to reopen the river. In around Durango, the river has actually just been reopened to recreation, which is kind of big news. That happened in the last hour.
Really? So people can go back and swim and do their stuff on the river?
As of 1 hour ago, I think the sheriff was in charge of reopening it, and he did put some caution around that. But obviously, you don't want to be drinking the water if it's untreated or anything. But it was reopened, and that's a big deal for rafting companies.
Yeah, the EPA has been criticized for not announcing the blowout quickly enough. Is there still tension, Grace, over this issue about how it was handled?
You know, it seems to be dissipating a little bit. I know last weekend, New Mexico in particular was very frustrated that they didn't get adequate notice about the spill. We heard from the governor saying she was really disturbed by the lack of information last week. But I was in New Mexico yesterday when Gina McCarthy visited there and visited with a couple of folks, and it does seem like some of that tension dissipated, and certainly the visit by the EPA administrator helped to ease that tension somewhat.
Mm. Jonathan, what kind of toxins were in the wastewater?
Well, it was very acidic water when it came out, and that acid had dissolved a bunch of metals into the water. And so it looks like the main components of that were arsenic, copper, manganese, and cadmium and zinc. And those are all potentially toxic at high enough levels, and they actually spiked up to pretty high levels. They went up, it looks like, near town in Durango, they shot up as much as 10 to 1,000 times the background levels that they were before as the plume moved through. So, it was pretty nasty stuff.
Yeah, you got to look at the wastewater coming down the Animas River. What did it look like to you?
Well, yeah, as soon as I found out that something had happened, I ran down to the river as close to my house as I could and looked there, and it hadn't reached town yet, and it was perfectly clear and looked green and that sort of thing. I drove upstream to the head of the plume and looked at it, and it looked like, some people are saying it's mustard color, but I would say more like tang with a bunch of turmeric in it. It was a very orange, bright orange kind of color, and it was very silty. You could see the sludge kind of boiling around in the water. It was a shocking sight.
And today, Jonathan and Grace, how does it look in comparison?
It looks great to me. It looks almost back to what it was that morning that I went down and looked at it in town. Really, it looks like it does any time after a rainstorm, just a little bit milky, I guess.
Yeah, it has a lot more translucent aspect to it than it did before.
Are there still remnants, though, of the wastewater along the banks of the river, Grace?
Yeah, you can see some of that orange sediment on the side of the river, and EPA is really testing the sediment to find out how much of a concern it is, what kind of concern it poses for health and some other aspects. And they haven't really gotten back those test results yet, but that matters because if you have a large spring runoff or something, that could stir up that sediment.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, even though this is brand new news, so to speak, a week for the country, I understand that that leaks from mines in the area is nothing new for people who live there.
No, it's not new at all. This has been going on since mining has been here, since the 1870s, and pretty much most mines leak something out. It's water that's acidic, loaded with heavy metals, and so combined, taken all together, all these mines after 140 years of mining, it adds up. And the Gold King mine that had the blowout, it was leaking, discharging before the blowout, and it will continue to discharge until somebody is able to figure out a way to stop it.
So this is a topic of conversation that goes on repeatedly.
Yeah, not to this level for sure. This has definitely elevated the conversation a lot, but it's often in the background, more so upstream because that's where it's actually happening. But we do feel the impacts here, another 60 miles downstream from where this spill actually occurred in Durango. The fish feel the impacts. It does impact aquatic life. So it is a dialogue that's been going on, but it's going to be much more intense now, I think.
Do you or Grace feel like it will become a Superfund site now? There have been attempts in the past to make it, and those have been sort of pushed aside. But do you think now that it might become a Superfund site?
I think it probably will. I think that there will be enough pressure from downstream communities to pressure the town of Silverton, which is the closest town to where the spill occurred, to pressure them to accept Superfund, because it's really the only thing I can imagine that could bring in enough resources to address this problem in a comprehensive way.
Yeah, and you talk to downstream users, and they really say that they feel the impacts of the decision that it wasn't made a Superfund site. So it's there's a lot more stakeholders now than there were maybe a couple months ago.
So
exactly.
After the national media heads out of town, you think this will, still be on a radar screen locally?
Oh, I definitely think it will be locally, yeah. I think that it's going to really inspire a movement here from Durango, probably from downstream users as well, who are also being impacted in New Mexico and even into Utah. I think that we'll be talking about it for a long time.
Yeah.
So what are the next steps now to the mine? What happens with the mine itself now that you've had this blowout? What are the next steps to take either in the cleanup or to shore up the blowout area?
Right now, go ahead, Grace.
I was just going to say the first thing they did was set up settling ponds to collect the mine discharge. So they're starting to treat that.
Mm-hmm. And is that a permanent solution?
I would say that is probably the best permanent solution, as crazy as it sounds. From what I understand, really, that the best way to deal with this problem is going to be to have a water treatment plant that treats the water as it comes out of the mine by putting in something to lower the pH, something similar to baking soda, lower the acidity so that the metals come out and clean the water. And that would have to run in perpetuity. And that's crazy sounding, but there's really no other way to do it, because if you plug these mines, what happens is that eventually the water is able to find its way out through cracks, natural fractures, sometimes through other mines, which is sort of the situation here, it looks like. So, yes, that's the solution, and it could cost as much as $1 million a year. So that's why we need money.
Yeah, Grace, you'd be testing the mine or the water for forever then. You'd be doing water tests about in the river and the areas of the mines.
Yeah, well, to monitor that and make sure that, you know, the water is being treated properly, that's pretty critical right now.
Is this the normally what they do with the mine, Jonathan? They do the water treatment like that?
They did, actually. There was a much larger mine near the Gold King that was in operation until 1991. And after they closed down, actually far before they closed down, starting in the 1970s, they started treating their water in the way that I described, in order to comply with the Clean Water Act. And then after they shut down and they started cleaning stuff up, they continued to treat the water to try to mitigate the problem. And then finally, when they left, after they left, the water treatment plant was shut down and water quality deteriorated pretty significantly.
Wow. We'll have to keep an eye on it like everybody else is. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Grace. Jonathan Thompson, senior editor at High Country News, who's based in Durango, Colorado. Grace Hood, energy and environment reporter for Colorado Public Radio. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how the voice sound of the candidates may influence how you think of them and whether which one you might vote for. Stay with us. We'll be right back, and also some tips on how to maybe make your own voice sound a little better. I could certainly use some. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The candidates have been squaring off this electoral season. And as you listen to the debates, what are you really listening to or listening for? Are you zeroing in on the issues, the candidates' answers to tough questions, or how often they stumble? Well, it turns out there might be even more subtle clues that influence the way you vote without you even realizing it. Take, for example, these two candidate pitches. Which one would you rather vote for?
I urge you to vote for me this November. I urge you to vote for me this November.
Which sounds stronger and more competent? Let's hear those one more time.
I urge you to vote for me this November. I urge you to vote for me this November.
Yes, the first one, it sounds a little bit higher, doesn't it? And that difference might influence your impression of the candidate. Casey Klofstad is an associate professor of political science at the University of Miami in Florida. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great to be with you.
You studied the voices of the candidates for the House of Representatives in 2012, and you compared that to those who won. And what did you find?
Yeah, so the recordings you played there earlier were from experiments we ran. But in a separate study, I looked at recordings of all of the major two-party candidates in the House elections in 2012. And what I found is that generally, the candidate with the lower-pitched voice won.
The lower-pitched voice?
Correct.
Yeah, I want to bring on another guest who's analyzed the voices of past politicians, and she coaches people on how to improve their voice and presentation skills. Susan Miller is founder of the company Voice Trainer. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Susan, you've done your own analyses of the voices of political candidates in the past. Do Casey's findings about lower voice being more attractive to voters ring true?
Yes, yes, it does. It's definitely true that lower voices are more attractive to speakers. I think we need to listen also to variability, the intonation of speakers. It isn't only a lower voice. I could be very low, but I might be very boring. So the intonation makes a difference also.
For example, Mitt Romney had a low voice, but he didn't win.
His voice was pretty monotonous when I analyzed it. There wasn't much pitch or loudness variability, which Casey couldn't his study is more scientific than mine, and I had loudness variability, which he cannot address in his because he's trying to keep the pitch constant.
Mm-hmm. So you believe that if you have a a monotonous voice, it doesn't matter whether it's lower or higher, that's a strike against you.
What do you think? If I talked like this, would I be very interesting to you?
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that from my own business.
Casey, have you a great voice.
Oh, thank you. Casey, have you looked into why people like lower voices?
Well, that was the most recent study that we conducted that was recently published in PLOS One with my colleagues from Florida Atlantic University and Duke University. Prior studies suggested that we like lower-pitched voices because they're perceived as stronger and more competent. That sort of makes sense on the face, but the problem is linking those mechanisms, if you will, to both leadership ability and pitch. So, for example, in the case of strength, strength is related to pitch because people with lower-pitched voices have more testosterone, for example, and thus are physically stronger and more socially aggressive. But it's unclear in the modern-day political context whether that type of strength, be it physical or social dominance, is going to make you a better leader. With regard to competence, we also have a disconnect there because there's really no way to say whether somebody with a lower pitched voice is actually a more competent leader. That led us to a third hypothesis that we wanted to test in the most recent study, and that's age. Age is interesting because it's related both to voice pitch and to leadership ability. Age is related to voice pitch because the pitch of your voice reaches its minimum in your 40s and 50s in mid-age. It decreases drastically in adolescence, bottoms out in mid-age, and then slowly creeps up as you go into your golden years. So it's related to pitch, and it's arguably also related to leadership ability in the sense that when you're in your 40s and 50s, for example, you're neither too young and too inexperienced to be a good leader, yet not too old to be a less effective, less vigorous leader. So we tested all three of those mechanisms in the most recent study.
Mm-hmm. And age, was it very much a factor?
Well, what we did is we found separately, right, all of these things are correlated. So we like lower pitch candidates because they're perceived as stronger, more competent, and older. But when you do the Pepsi challenge, if you will, if you stack all of these three factors up and sort of make these mechanisms fight amongst each other to say which one is actually explaining why we like lower pitched candidates, strength and competence explain most of the variation in our voting behavior. Age still matters, but to about a third less.
Huh. Susan, I'm going out on a limb here, but just to give people an idea of what to listen for when judging voice pitch and pitch variance, can you do a little analysis on my voice and explain what you listen for? I'm afraid to listen to the answer.
Well, I listen to voice in terms of the pitch, but I also listen to the intonation. Is your voice pleasant to listen to? Is it attractive? Is it pleasing? I listen to delivery aspects, though, also. Rate of speech, is it so fast that you can't really understand what I'm saying? I listen to whether a person uses a lot of fillers, such as and Are there tentative statements? So now we're getting into more of the messaging components that were very apparent in the debates, that even though Bernie Sanders was the oldest in 74 and had a voice that was forced and thin, his message really resonated with the audience.
So you coach people and candidates. What is your message to people who want to be candidates? To vary their voices, to practice at it?
Well, the voice is an instrument, and we all can learn to use our voice as well. Everyone, we think we're born with a given voice and we can't change it, but that's not true. I can speak in a very nasal tone, or I can speak like this, you know, or I can speak British and keep it all up front, you know. I mean, it's an instrument, it's the way we use it. So when we're relaxed and if we use breath support from below, our voice will be more full. If we open our throat, keep our vocal folds relaxed, we won't get the tight, thin voice that we heard when Rand Paul interrupted Governor Christie several times. His voice got very thin and very tight. And he naturally has a higher pitch. He's a shorter person. He's 5 foot, what is he, 5'8". 5'8" is opposed to Trump, who's 6'3", or Jeb Bush, who's 6'3". So size will also make a difference in voice. But people can learn to use their voice in an attractive, pleasant way. The one problem is people don't like the way they sound when they hear their voice on an answering machine. Do you, when you hear your voice back, do you say, I kind of like it or I don't?
I hate it. Been hating it for 40 years.
No, you don't really. Do you?
I do. No, I always think people have their own worst critics of their voice.
Oh, well, when I'm training people, you know, I say I always ask, do you like your voice? And everyone always says no. And I said, well, if you put your hands around, cup your hands around your ears, that's really what you sound like to other people. So you can change it and start leaving messages on your voice memo, changing your voice, talking nasal and then talking thin and then talking with a more resonant voice, using breath, not using breath, and find the voice that you like.
Casey, what happens when, in your research, when a male candidate goes up against a female candidate, as could very well happen in the next presidential election, is it just a lower voice? What will people be listening for?
Well, you're really predicting the future of our research agenda because we actually haven't tackled that question yet. It's difficult to sort of envision a research design where you could keep a lot of things constant and yet pit a male's voice versus a female voice and yet have a gap in pitch. But that's something that we're continuing to work on. Anecdotally, though, if you want to think about voice pitch, because of differences in hormones and the physiology of men and women, and I'm sure Dr. Miller could speak to this as well, women have higher voices than men. So arguably, voice pitch, knowing that we prefer candidates with lower voice, is at the very least a biologically determined factor that will hamper women at the polls. Or at the very least, it's a factor that does not go against patriarchal social norms.
Susan, do you think this whole bias for lower voices really plays out in the real world as a bias against women in a way against female leaders and executives?
I'm not sure. We have more members in the members of Congress that are women now than ever before. We have about 108, which is a lot higher than before. But I do think lower pitches are much more pleasant to listen to. And often, you know, we can't change the length and the width of our and the depth of our thickness of our vocal folds, but we can change the way we use our voice in breath control and relaxing the larynx or voice box and relaxing our throat. Everyone can have a lower-pitched voice, and I think with women, that's something that we should try to work on and achieve because it is important. I do think it's important.
So then what would you say to Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton, I listened to her messaging also, and her messages are very clear. Her pitch is lower. When one thing I found in 2008 when I analyzed that speech of hers, she became very emotional as when many women become emotional, the pitch gets very much higher, and it almost gets us in that shrieky, panicky kind of mode because the vocal folds tighten and the pitch raises. So to keep women calm and relaxed, I sense when I listened to her economic speech in California, her pitch was lower, and she didn't get into the emotional changes that she had in the prior speeches that I had heard her in. So I think she's doing pretty well with that, actually. The fillers, she does use quite a few fillers, then I think that detracts from the message and has you appear less certain of your message.
And how does her voice characteristics compare with Carly Fiorina?
They're both about 5'8", 5'7". Their pitches, I think Carly's is a bit lower than Hillary's is. Carly keeps her voice a little bit lower with less inflection than does Hillary.
So which would be more important? And I'll ask both of you, would inflection be more important than how low your voice is, varying your voice or keeping it lower?
For women, I'd say keeping it lower with less inflection, vary your pitch two notes up or two notes down. I think more important and as important is really having a command of the facts. And that's what Carly Fiorina did so well. Rule one. Rule two, rule three. She had simple declarative statements that gave her a great delivery and a command of the facts.
Casey, you've also looked into how much faces matter compared to voice pitch. How much do they matter?
Yeah, and this is fresh off the press. We actually haven't published these results yet. But knowing that there are many different factors that play into how we judge candidates, we wanted to add faces into this. So we've taken our experiments where we have people vote between candidates with higher and lower pitched voices, i.e. more competent or less competent voices, and then paired those voices with competent and incompetent faces. And we find, again, that we like candidates with lower voices, and as you might imagine, we prefer candidates with faces that are perceived as more competent. But again, if you stack these together, as we did in our other studies, and do this quote-unquote Pepsi challenge, we find that the facial, the visual signal matters about three times more than the vocal signal. So when you look at, in tandem, faces and voices, the visual matters most in determining vote choice.
And when you say visual, what are the parameters that you're judging?
So what we did is that in a first study, we basically created a study to create stimuli for the second study, which is what I just explained to you. But the first study, we had our experimental subjects look at pictures of the current members of Congress and just rate their competence. And what we did is we took the top five rated men and top five rated women and the bottom five rated women and the bottom five rated men, and those were our stimuli. So faces that were perceived as competent and incompetent, both men and women, and we paired those with higher and lower pitched voices.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about whether voices matter or faces, talking with Susan Miller, founder of the company Voice Trainer, Casey Klofstad, associate professor of political science, University of Miami in Florida. So appearance matters more than, well, would it matter more than content? We're able to judge that at all. Susan, Casey, do you have any opinion on that?
First of all, I really appreciate the research that Dr. Klofstad's doing. This is great to get it out and have people realize that they can change, which is great. When you're thinking about faces and you think about Trump leading the polls, he has a very serious look, doesn't he? He's frowning. Most of what he did during the debate, squinted eyes. He has a broad chest. He's very tall. He's 6'3". And he has wide gestures. His gestures were much more outside his body than anyone else's. So in terms of visual, but then also his message is feeding off the general discontent of the populace. You know, that angry, he's really feeding to the anger of people wanting things to change also. So I think he's a great study, isn't he, on the whole idea of facial and posture and body language.
Mm-hmm. Casey?
The question you raise, I think, is a really important normative one for how we perceive other people and, at the end of the day, for what I study, how we govern ourselves, in the sense that there is, at times, a disconnect between the message and the medium that message is being conveyed through. We find that we have biases, for example, in favor of candidates with lower-pitched voices, and we find that correlates most strongly with the perception that they are stronger and more competent. But we have yet to determine whether that is true. So that leads to a real important question. Are we making good choices? Are our thin impressionistic judgments that we're making based on these biologically determined characteristics sort of leading us down the wrong path? That's really what we need to figure out. And we also need to recognize that those biases exist, that we're not so set apart from the rest of the animal kingdom, that we are indeed influenced by these thin cues that are encoded in nonverbal vocal stimuli. And we need to realize that, like the rest of the animal kingdom, those influences can impact us and how we treat each other.
You agree, Susan?
Definitely agree.
Yeah.
One thing I coach people on when we're talking about body posture is Amy Cuddy's TED Talks on body language and how you should stand, if you're going into a job interview or giving a presentation, stand for 2 minutes in a very open, a very wide posture, a very powerful posture, like a Superman posture, and that posture, she has found, increases testosterone by 20% and decreases cortisol or your anxiety hormone by 25%. So I think we're headed in the right direction in terms of really defining what factors can help us be more confident speakers.
Mm-hmm. Can you overdo it? Can you hurt your voice by trying to speak too low?
Yes, you can. If people press their vocal folds, it's vocal fry, but it's also a pressed tone. Oftentimes, corporate executives or people that use their voices for a long period of time get in this pressed voice, which is, this isn't fry, but this is, I'm pressing my voice. I'm using my false vocal folds. Rather than resonating, using air and allowing my voice to come forward into the mask. So pressing a voice can often make it very tired. Glottal fry, yes. Glottal fry is when you let your voice drop at the end of your sentence. My name is Susan Miller. My company's Voice Trainer. And it's just allowing the breath to drop before you get to that final word.
All right. Well, I have to allow my voice to do something and say goodbye to both of you, unfortunately. Susan Miller, founder of the company Voice Trainer, which coaches people on their voices and presentation skills. Casey Klefstad, associate professor of political science, University of Miami in Florida. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. At the end of July, the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, rang in its 25th anniversary. In the years since its first passed, a new era for accessibility has arisen: mobile technology. A couple of days before the act's anniversary, Apple CEO Tim Cook tweeted the following: "Accessibility rights are human rights. Celebrating 25 years of the ADA, we're humbled to improve lives with our products." And Apple's iOS has lots of features that make it user-friendly for people living with a range of disabilities, from things like VoiceOver and Siri for people who are blind, have low vision or limited mobility, to FaceTime, which can allow people who are deaf to call each other. Third-party developers are also working to build apps and mobile technology that aren't only user-friendly for people living with disabilities, but specifically address their needs. And in this installment of App Chat, we're talking about assistive technology, including what's on the market, what might be coming down the pipeline. Let me introduce my guests. Stephen Aquino is a San Francisco-based tech journalist and iOS accessibility expert. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. Sean Horn, an exemplar in the AT&T and New York University's Ability Labs Connectability Challenge, which called on software developers to create new technologies and apps for people living with disabilities. Welcome to Science Friday, Sean.
Hi.
Hi. Anita Purr, a clinical professor of occupational therapy at NYU who helped organize the Connectability Challenge. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here.
Stephen, let me ask you first what it means to be an iOS accessibility expert.
So what that means for me is I draw my knowledge of iOS on the fact that I'm disabled myself, and I use a lot of iOS's accessibility technologies, like things like large dynamic type, and so I think that I am really sort of the target market for these sort of things.
Let's talk about some of the apps that are easy for people living with disabilities to use, as well as ones geared directly to this audience. Tell me about Overcast.
Overcast is iOS podcast app developed by Margo Arment, and it is one of my favorite apps on my iPhone. I'm a huge podcast fan, and the thing that I really enjoy about Overcast is the Now playing screen. That's my favorite part, because the buttons on the screen for adjusting playback and such are huge, and that makes them really easy to see and tap, and so I don't need to struggle to find things.
Have you heard of TapTapC?
Yes, I've heard of it.
What is it? What does it do?
It's a camera app that is designed for the blind. So what'll happen is it uses voiceover technology to inform the person of the camera controls, like the shutter, and it also, when you've taken a picture, it'll tell you that it's taking the picture, but but then also if it can, it'll tell you what you've taken.
Wow. Anita, let's talk about the connectability challenge. Tell us a little bit more what that was.
Sure, I'd be happy to. We worked with AT&T and the Ability Lab, which is a NYU group comprised of the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development, the NYU School of Engineering, and the Tisch School of the Arts. And we worked together to identify what sorts of things we would like developers to make. And we categorized disability and needs. And then we asked four people with disabilities, Sean is one of those people, if they would be like a spokesperson to talk about their own disabilities and what sorts of things they'd like for technology to do for them. It was an international call for developers, and we had input from people from across the world and had 63 final applications or software that was submitted for judging. And then the judging was just done late last month, and the winners were announced at a press conference with an app called Kinetic Mouse or Kinesic Mouse as the winner. And what that is an application so that facial gestures can control mouse movement. So somebody who's paralyzed and can't move their hands to move the mouse can move it through a series of facial gestures. We also had another exemplar. One of the people working with us is Gus, and he is blind. And he also tried that same app and found that it was very useful also for people who are blind.
Sean, do you find that there is a developers want to make apps for people with disabilities?
Well, they do now. No, I mean, I think that was what was so beautiful about the connectability challenge is that it got people excited about solving everyday issues for not just someone else's problem. This is, you know, a universal issue that I think everyone does want to create solutions if possible. And it started a conversation, really. I guess it helps that they gave away money as well, but hopefully, you know, it starts a conversation about what's left to be done. And it was amazing to see the creativity that people had. And just to piggyback off of what Anita was saying, actually Gus was instrumental in helping Marcus, the winner, to create something that was, blind friendly, if you will, because it was not at the time that he submitted it, but they were able to actually adapt it with a screen reader to make it so much more accessible for a wide range of people. So it's really exciting to see what that kind of partnership can do.
Was that your favorite app, or did you have another favorite submission?
Well, that was pretty amazing. But I personally, at least for what I requested, which was hands-free technology, I'm really excited about Drum Pants. Not only is Drum Pants, it started as a musical app, that someone could tap their body and make music, but now has become something that is a verbal aid for those that are nonverbal, and it allows you to text and pick up your phone and take pictures with your phone without picking it up. So that was huge for me because as I've said many times, I traverse the world with shiny blue ski poles, so my hands are busy, and this is a huge help for me. And I think also Enlight was pretty amazing, which is this navigation app that allows people with blindness to navigate new spaces, like a new store, or, it can be very daunting when you don't have any guidance in a new space. Most of us can look around and figure out, okay, there's the bathroom, there's this, there's what I need. But it is a different story for Gus and others with blindness. So it was fantastic. Those are, a couple of standouts. Yeah. There's a lot more, but yeah.
I can imagine. Anita, there was one submission called Palette, which would allow people to use their tongues to use their smartphones.
That's right. Yeah.
Tell us how.
It's pretty amazing. It looks similar to the way a retainer looks, that a piece goes into your mouth and rests against your hard palate in the roof of your mouth. And it has spots on it that are essentially buttons and acts in the center of it. Remember on like a IBM laptop had that little nib in the middle that you could move around for mouse control. It has one of those in the top of it that you can move with the tip of your tongue to move the cursor on the screen. It's a fabulous technology, and I expect that they will continue to work on it, and that it has a huge capacity for usefulness for people with disabilities, but also for people without disabilities, so that they again can have their hands free to do other things while they're interacting with their computers.
Stephen, you're an iOS accessibility expert. We mentioned a few iOS features in the introduction that make the iPhone easier to use. Let's talk about what are some of the features that you like.
There are so many, but I'll just to name a few. My favorite feature is something called large dynamic type, and what that does is there's a slider in the accessibility settings where someone can go and they can adjust the size of the font to be as small or as large as they have to, and it'll actually show you with some sample text how big or how small.
I know some senior citizens who are use that a lot.
And
it's not just the senior citizens. You would laugh if you saw what my text messaging looked like.
And it's so awesome because once you have set the size, then any app within the phone, like Apple's apps, all support it. The apps that come on the phone, but there's also developer hooks where a third-party developer can hook into that feature, and then that setting will also apply to his or her app.
Yeah. Sean, is it true that you just switched from a flip phone last year to an iPhone? You
guilty,
a late adapter?
Guilty. Although I will not say I was not bribed by AT&T or anything. It was actually last September that I made the switch, because it was time to join the 21st century. And at first I was reluctant, but I have to tell you that I can't go back now. I'm spoiled for life.
I'll bet.
It just does too many great things. What can I say?
Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. It's okay, Anita. Go ahead.
I just wanted to mention that there are a lot of people that are still using the more traditional flip phones because a lot of people find the keyboards easier to manage if they have any tremor or any incoordination. Sometimes the flat screen of a smartphone is really difficult to use.
Agreed.
Is there a feature or some assistive technology that doesn't exist yet that you'd like to have that somebody should be working on? Steve, let me ask you first.
I think that when you look at iOS, I use iOS day in and day out, and you just go to the accessibility screen and you look at all the options and features that are there. Everything is so comprehensive from eyesight to motor to hearing. That sort of breadth and depth is why I think Apple is really leading the charge in servicing people with disabilities.
I see you have an iWatch on also. Sean, Anita, anything that you must have that you'd love to see?
Sean, you go ahead first.
I would love a robot butler, to be honest. I don't know that that would be available on a phone, but, you know, if we're talking about wildest dreams, that's what I would need, because the other obstacle now that this challenge has sort of addressed my hands-free wish for, you know, answering my phone, it would be great to have some help carrying things, which I don't know what app there can be, but since people are quite brilliant and surprise me every day, that would be sort of my wildest dreams request. Off the top of my head at the moment. Yeah.
I could understand that. Anita?
Well, there's a couple of things going on right now as far as accessibility goes, and there's two apps that are in development. They're available, and they're using crowdsourcing to identify accessibility features in public places. So as people go into a restaurant or they go into a store, they can identify where the stairs are, if the bathroom is accessible, if there's noise and distraction for people with autism. I think that kind of information needs to be made available for people. Those two apps, one is called Access Together, and the other one is called AXS Map. And then the other thing, too, is that the way that I think about it, I don't like it that it's for people with disabilities and people without disabilities. I think that there should be more of a continuum where you can get the app that you need because you need it, not because you're looking in the accessibility features. So I wish it was
just all kind of universal, available.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good idea. We've run out of time. I want to thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Steve Aquino, San Francisco-based tech journalist and iOS accessibility expert. Sean Horn, an exemplar in the AT&T and NYU Abilities Lab Connect Abilities Challenge. Anita Purr, clinical professor of occupational therapy at NYU. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Quick invitation. The Sci-Fi Book Club is reading Tracy Kidder's True Tech Tale, The Soul of a New Machine. And you can meet the engineers who built that new machine. Come join us. That's Wednesday, August 19th at 6 p.m. More info at sciencefriday.com/book club. Get tickets before they sell out. BJ Liederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to production partners at the City University of New York and to Monte Carlos and our engineer Jim Bennett and all the folks at KQED for having us here today. Thank you all for your hospitality. I'm Ira Flatow in San Francisco.